from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part three in a series of discussions about the art of literary biography. My guest is Robert Martin, Professor Emeritus of English at Princeton University. Our topics are the life and work of Alfred Lord Tennyson, the Victorian poet who lived from 1809 till 1892. Robert Martin is the author of Tennyson, The Unquiet Heart, a literary biography first published in 1980 and recently issued in paperback.
A man's life seems to me to be essentially that with which he is engaged all the time, that with which he's constantly preoccupied, that which he works on.
How important is it that you look at the details of an individual's life when you're considering the life itself and the connection between these sort of mundane, everyday things and the larger literary concerns?
Well, I think somewhere you have to do it. I suppose what I'm really talking about is metaphor here. You have to find that action which seems to you somehow symbolic of what the man is, what he's attempting to do. Obviously, you don't want to clutter it up with every mundane detail of what's gone on in his life. W.H. Auden calculated once that any man, or not any man perhaps, but the average man, each day had enough action happen to him to fill the average length novel. Well, now obviously you can't do that. I could even name you a few biographers who have attempted to put every detail in, but I think it's a mistaken idea, because so much of what goes on in one's own life is not really significant so far as distinguishing one person from another. And it seems to me that when you do put detail into a biography, what you want to do is to find that one which is going to go right to the heart of the character, the personality, the work, or the individuality of the subject.
Well, let me ask you, by way of referring to some of the work that you have done on Tennyson, or perhaps some of the work that you're engaged in now, you're working on Edward Fitzgerald. How do you figure out what's major and what's minor so that a reader coming away from or coming to your biography doesn't sort of say, well, I got the high points, now I know how this person lived?
I wish I could answer that question for you. Obviously, it's a question that's impossible. I'd say best that it's very much like being asked, what is someone you know like? You're immediately going to pull out the threads which disengage those things which seem most important to you. Now, in part, what you do is to judge the length of what you're going to write. I don't mean you know exactly whether it's going to be 175 or 502 pages, but you have some sense of the length and the importance of it, and consequently, into that length of time, you've got to decide whether you're going to give only the high points that you talk about, or whether you're going to flesh them out and make them seem more and more, well, I suppose resilient is the word, so that you touch them and they feel alive.
Well, what did you do with Tennyson? How did you figure out what needed to be told about this man?
Well, I lived with him for 6 years is essentially what I did. I read, this is a rough calculation, something like 50,000 unpublished letters. Well, you know a great deal about a man by the time you've done that.
Is that a primary source? Is that the kind of thing that a biographer relies on most heavily?
If he's lucky. I was lucky. They were there. They aren't for most biographers.
How much of Tennyson's life was interesting on a day-to-day basis?
Day-to-day, I don't know. I discarded that, which wasn't. You see, really what you're asking is for me to put into words for you in a highly conscious fashion that which is not a conscious process. You spin any work out of your belly, I think, rather than out of your head. And somewhere along the line, I get the idea, well, this is right. It feels right. I can read it back, and that says to me, that's the way he sounds, that's the way he feels, that's the way he resonates in my head. And that's the best I can tell you. That sounds very vague and indefinite, and indeed it is, but that's what you have to do. You have it essentially to trust your own taste, your own sense of another person.
Professor Martin, you've written some detective novels. Let me ask you to make the leap between detective fiction and mysteries and the writing of literary biography. Do you find yourself thinking like a detective when you're putting an individual's life together?
No leap, except that there's always in a detective novel an absolute answer. There's no absolute answer in biography. I wish there were. Uh-huh. I wish there were right and wrong.
Let's talk a little bit more about Lord Tennyson. How would you describe the shape of his life in terms of the evidence that you used in writing this biography?
I suppose what I really got interested in first, not why I wrote the biography, but what began to give me a clue, a thread into his life, was when I began understanding a great deal that nobody else had ever come across about his antecedents, about his father, his grandfather, his mother, and an uncle, and the relationships between these persons, and how much they shaped his life, which I had not been aware of before, nor indeed I think of anyone else, and how much unconsciously he modeled his own behavior, or indeed reacted against it.
How much, therefore, is biography an argument about the way an individual lives? In other words, how much of a thesis, preconceived sorts of things, do you bring to the writing of biography? I'm thinking, for instance, of the title of your book on Tennyson, The Unquiet Heart.
Well, that's only too easy to answer, because the title was found long after the biography was finished. But obviously the title, nonetheless, somehow is meant to encapsulate something of what I meant by the biography, in which I do go on to complete the quotation on the title page from In Memoriam to indicate that Tennyson often used poetry as a way out of the difficulties of his own emotions, as a way to resolve problems that he had himself. This is a perfectly standard 19th and 20th century attitude to poetry, of course. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any preconception. This sounds very odd, but I knew very little about Tennyson before I began writing it. I was asked to write the book, and I said, yes. And the reason that I said yes was because I did know so little. Now, I had actually taught Tennyson. This doesn't mean I had never read Tennyson or that I knew nothing about his life. What it did mean is that I had never really quite considered him, never pulled the life and the poetry together for my own satisfaction. It's difficult to say why he hadn't engaged me, and I suddenly thought, when I was asked to write this, well, to know something about that man, let's write a book and find out about it. And this seems to me the real purpose of writing, is to set yourself a problem and find what seems a workable answer to you.
Professor Martin, let me ask you a really sort of brash kind of question. What gives you the right to poke around in these dusty old bones and try to make these people public? Now, granted, Tennyson was the poet laureate and he was public, but what impels a writer to do biography? To make his subject public.
I think you're asking two questions here. Why a writer writes biography, and what right he has to make the life public. Mm-hmm. I think I'll go to the second of those first. Right, I'm not certain, except that we all have curiosity. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that insofar as we have the right to know anything about our past, that great men are certainly part of our past. Do we have right to know about the minute aspects of their life, their sexual life, their private life, in all kinds of ways that they would like to have kept quiet? I don't think it's a very easy answer to that, except that it does seem to me that anyone who exposes himself to public gaze is necessarily taking on himself the curiosity of other persons. That is to say that I don't think that anyone can be in public life and say, I have a right to private life as well, unless you really and truly believe that public and private life have nothing to do with each other. Mm. Now, I happen to believe, as I should have thought practically everyone in the 20th century does, that what makes up a man's private personality certainly determines to a great extent what he does in public. To that extent, I think that we certainly have the right. Now, I think that so long, my own belief, I can't go beyond that, my own belief is that so long as a man is alive, let him protect his private life as much as he wants to. It seems to me perfectly fair. And I don't think it should be invaded any more than can be helped. I think once he is dead, Once he can no longer be hurt himself, I mean, after all, this is the legal position. Once he can no longer be hurt himself, and if he has deliberately made himself a public figure, as indeed Tennyson did, to accept the post of poet laureate in the first place is to become a public figure. And he wasn't a stupid man, so he knew before he became that. Well, once he has accepted that post, then it seems to me he is not fair game for anything, but certainly for legitimate curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Professor Martin, let me ask you this. How closely did, in Tennyson's case, the private life and the public life parallel or diverge one another? Was there a great disparity there? Was there a great sort of similarity?
Well, I think that Tennyson certainly gave this monolithic appearance to the public of a man who had almost no private doubts, almost no difficulties, who simply existed as a rather rugged person from whom books issued at fairly regular intervals. Mm-hmm. He guarded his own privacy a great deal. I think at the very time, however, that he did guard his privacy so jealously that this almost inevitably gave rise to curiosity about what went on under the surface. It's very difficult to say what is the difference between them, because it seems to me that both the surface and the interior are the real man.
Mm-hmm. Professor Martin, you have mentioned letters as one of the kinds of evidence that a literary biographer uses. What other kinds of resources and devices did you find yourself drawing on when you were writing about Tennyson?
Well, if I may rephrase your question.
Sure.
This sounds rude, and I don't mean it to be at all. I should say that I want to talk about letters first. It seems to me why they are so very important is not for the information on a factual level that you can mm-hmm. copy out, but rather the revelation that they give you about the interior life of the subject of the biography.
So it's not just chronology.
Oh, no, not at all. That seems to me, in essence, the least part of what you get out of letters. We all reveal ourselves when we're writing, and I think most importantly, a literary man who is constantly aware of the possibilities of language is giving us a great deal, in the same way that a poem says a great deal more than can be reduced to a mm-hmm. to a phrase or two about it. Well, now, this is why I wanted to rephrase your question, was because it seems to me that other things become in part shadows of this. A journal is very, very useful. It will certainly reveal day-to-day activity, if you want to know that for the moment. In addition to that, it has part of the quality of a letter. But what it doesn't have is the variousness of letters. That is to say that a diary or a journal is essentially addressed to the man who is writing it. It's addressed to himself. Letters are addressed to many different kinds of person, and what you do there is to get many sides of a man revealed, both the sides that he wants to reveal and those that he doesn't, because he's inevitably playing some kind of part with other persons, just as you and I sitting here talking, because we are on the particular basis we are right now, are talking to each other in a very different way than we would if we were sitting down having a beer together and had never seen a microphone.
That's right. Are you saying, Professor Martin, that people who keep journals and who therefore see facets in themselves, who are hiding and revealing things, and people who write a lot of letters, that they really want to have themselves written about? Did you get that feeling with Tennyson?
Well, I certainly did on occasion. I don't think always. I wish I could remember the poem that Robert Frost, it's called The Secret, in which he talks about how each of us has a secret that we want desperately to have other people find out.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that almost everyone whose letters I know is constantly hinting about things to friends. I don't know how conscious it is.
Professor Martin, let's come back to Tennyson just parenthetically on that. Of all the things that Tennyson could have revealed about himself and is revealing about himself in his letters, what if you could pick one or two things, what is it that you came away from the writing of the biography with a sense of urgency that here Tennyson wanted this known about himself?
Well, I think probably it's a pretty big thing. It's a kind of complex structure of facts about his life, most of which were never revealed. I think perhaps I'd have to say that it stems from the fact that his own family had a long history of epilepsy in it. He was terrified of it. And of course, epilepsy was, during his lifetime, a very shameful disease. It was something you couldn't possibly mention to anyone. The family would be disgraced if anyone knew about epilepsy.
And this was due almost strictly to a social convention?
Yes, because it was thought to be a form of insanity.
I see.
And it was thought to be almost inevitably inherited. Now, Tennyson's father certainly had epilepsy. His uncle, a cousin, and probably his grandfather had epilepsy, which certainly would suggest that there was an incidence, if nothing else, in the family. Tennyson was frightened of this himself. Now, he couldn't ever reveal that he had this, but I think it resulted...
He was, in fact, epileptic.
No, he wasn't.
I see.
That is to say, so far as you can diagnose backwards, probably he was not, but he thought he was. And therefore, for a very long time, he was frightened to get married for fear that he would pass it on to his children. In about 1850, he discovered, it was 1848, 1849, somewhere along there, he discovered that what he had always thought was epilepsy was not. And then he was free to marry. But at the very time that this happened, what it meant to him was that, it was so strong that he wrote a great many poems in which somebody has a disease very like epilepsy and finally discovers that it is not something harmful. Well, it explains a great deal about important poems like In Memoriam, Maud, The Princess, and several others, and parts of The Idylls of the King. Now, what I'd love to have more than anything else is to have two or three letters from Tennyson talking about having epilepsy. But, of course, he never does. He could never have brought himself to put that on paper.
This is what you mean by the inseparability of the life from the work.
Oh, sure, sure. Now, I don't mean that he ever said, oh, I've got epilepsy, so I'm going to sit down and write about it. But I do think that it's so consciously, or so unconsciously present, always in his mind, that when he does sit down to write, he can't help drawing out what is occupying him, no matter what form he puts it in.
Professor Martin, at what point does chronology break down or diverge into interpretation as one writes literary biography?
That's a very tough question. I can only say that I don't think that given the same set of facts, large body of fact, let's say, that any two biographers in the world could write the same biography of the subject, which would inevitably indicate that something of their own personality was filtering through. And I suppose that's probably what you mean by interpretation.
How much did you think of yourself as a chronicler, and how much did you feel the responsibility of interpretation? Which seemed most serious to you?
I think the responsibility of interpretation. Well, this was a rather easy case because the external events of his life were pretty much known and have been known for a long time. His son wrote a very, very long biography indeed, which fills in almost all the outlines of what he did and when he did it. But it's pretty dull going. He doesn't ever say why he did it. He doesn't ever begin to dig into his father's head, and he would have thought it was a horrible thing to do, and he certainly didn't do it. Now, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to find out what he was like inside. That's the only reason I would want to write biography, as a matter of fact.
Let me ask you a really terribly unfair question. Have you written a definitive biography?
Oh, no,
is there such a thing as...
There is no such thing. I'm absolutely positive of it.
That's part of the ground rules.
For me, I simply accept the fact that nobody has written a definitive biography in the past and that mine never will be. After all, new evidence comes up. I don't think it's going to be very contradictory. I do think it's going to enlarge what we know, flesh out, if it does.
Professor Martin, how much should the writing of literary biography be subject to, well, if you want to be critical, you could say trendiness, things like feminist interpretation, psychobiography, deconstruction, and how much of it has a core to it that really doesn't change, that, as you say, is going to provide the basis for other biographies?
Well, I think that probably all these things you're talking about are essentially like the personal biases of any biographer brings to writing.
But they also reflect larger social issues, do they not?
Of course they do, but it does seem to me that what's happening in both cases is that insofar as it is possible, you must consider that a large issue, whether it's political in the narrow sense of that word, whether it's philosophical, whether it's theological, or indeed whether it's the personal quality of the biographer himself, all these things are must be accepted because they're the ways you get into him. They're a way of becoming interested. If, on the other hand, it seems your own personal biases or the issues which you are investigating remain more important than the subject himself and you're unwilling to budge any of those in the face of the evidence, then I don't think you're going to get a very good biography.
Professor Martin, what did you enjoy most about writing your book about Tennyson?
Finishing it. That's easy. No, I don't think that's true. My own feeling about this sort of work is that research is the drudgery. I'm unlike most scholars this way, I think. Research is the drudgery for me. Writing is the carrot that I hold out in front of the donkey. In the case of the Tennyson biography, it took me, if I remember correctly, and it's a little hard to be absolutely accurate now, it took me from something over between five and six years to do the book, of which five and a half years were spent in research. And I was waiting for the six months in which I wrote some 600 pages, which is too fast to write a book, but that's what I wanted to do, and all the research I had done had been solidifying what I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. What did I enjoy most? It was the writing. I love writing, that's the truth of the matter, and I'm nervous as a cat if I'm not writing.
Let's turn the coin over, Professor Martin. What was it that you didn't like about doing this book on Tennyson?
Well, I liked doing all of it. There was no problem about the doing of it that I didn't like. I'm not sure that the most satisfactory thing that came out of the book, though, was the criticism in it. And it's not because I wasn't interested in it, but because I had known the poetry for a great deal longer than I had known the life. And consequently, I couldn't help but be more enthusiastic about the discoveries I was making that were very new. And I don't think I found as much in the criticism. After all, people have been writing criticism of Tennyson for a century. The thing that did surprise me in the book, however, was that I discovered that the poems that I loved by the time I had finished writing the biography were precisely the same ones that I had loved long before. Now, this may prove either that my brain is totally impervious to new ideas, or it may prove that some of his work is a good deal better than the rest of it and that I had recognized this in the past. Mm-hmm. Not everybody would agree with me, of course.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the life and work of the Victorian poet laureate, Alfred Lord Tennyson. My guest was Robert Martin, Professor Emeritus of English at Princeton University. Professor Martin is the author of Tennyson, The Unquiet Heart, a literary biography published in 1980. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be Robert Louis Stevenson, and my guest will be Professor Roger Swearingen of the University of California. Soundings concludes now with a comment that recalls one of Professor Martin's observations about Tennyson, that a man's life seems to be essentially that with which he is engaged all the time, that which he works on. Here is Robert Ginger, an editorial writer and book critic from Greensboro, North Carolina, who asks, "Who are you?"
In Wonderland, the smoke ring blowing caterpillar keeps asking Alice this question. How often we ask this of ourselves is another matter. And for better or worse, who we are derives to a large extent from what we do. What many of us do is lose ourselves in our work, which is a good thing, for the most part. We work to keep body and soul together. Survival is the biggest deal of all. But in the process of providing, we tend to lose ourselves so utterly in our work that often our other dreams and hopes become numbed, inseparable from the work itself. And so, the week's labor makes us relinquish any vision outside our 40 hours honest labor. In the end, imaginations become dulled, dreams imperiled. As someone once said, variety may be the spice of life, but monotony puts the bread on the table. But with the monotony, we begin the long habit of confusing persistence with existence. This deadening of curiosity, of life as adventure, is the very thing that makes work quiet desperation. Want to see it for yourself? Take a drive on an early workday morning and notice the impassive faces, more like masks, really, glaring through auto windshields. But we have to work. We can't just twile away our lives like Peter Pan. Maybe what we need is even more work, but the right kind of more work. Once we've managed to keep a roof of sorts over our heads and stave the wolves from the door, the really tough work begins. I mean the job of examining and extending our lives. Human nature withers without a muscular philosophy or religion. To that extent, the unexamined life is indeed not worth living. Sure, too much self-examination may be a dangerous thing, ask Hamlet, but if we fall to pieces, it will likely be from paying too little rather than too much regard to the life within. Nothing, the author of Peter Pan tells us, is really work unless you would rather be doing something else. Often we think we'd rather be doing anything else. At the same time, we can be protectively arrogant about our own work, so as to insulate ourselves from others who have taken divergent roads. It makes our own choice more manageable. Beware the party conversation stopper. And what do you do? Oh, I see. This is not the open-ended question of Wonderland's caterpillar. It's a filing away. Expect a weakly suppressed yawn, a glance at the watch, zero attention span. To lose the spirited curiosity about ourselves and others, regardless of what we may or may not do, is nothing short of tragic. It's not always easy to avoid this loss. We must buckle down to the really hard work of examining our lives. This ritual task can foster regard for our own and others' worth. As Robertson Davies, the Canadian writer, prescribes, you must set aside 1 hour of your life every day for yourself, in which you attempt to understand what you're doing. Is that all there is to it, we may ask? Davies continues, do you think it sounds easy? Try it and find out. All kinds of things will interfere. People, spouses, lovers, friends, children, employees, teachers, enemies, and all the multifarious army of mankind will want that hour, and they'll have all sorts of blandishments to persuade you to yield it to them. And the worst enemy of all, yourself, will find so many things that seem attractive upon which the hour can be spent. It's extremely difficult to claim that hour solely for the task of understanding, questioning, and deciding. It's Monday morning, and I'm driving to work. In a reverie, I imagine that we all have agreed to Davies' counsel. We are claiming part of our hour for understanding, questioning, and deciding. Some of our faces behind the glass bubbles are smiling, some frowning. But in that dream, one thing at least is certain. We're all alive.
Robert Ginger is an editorial writer and book critic from Greensboro, North Carolina. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 3 in the Soundings series on literary biography. My guest is Robert Martin, Professor Emeritus of English at Princeton University. Professor Martin is the author of Tennyson, The Unquiet Heart, a literary biography of the Victorian Poet Laureate. What sort of evidence contributes to the writing of literary biography? Is it desirable or necessary for a literary biographer in his subject to disengage the life from the work? The Art of Literary Biography, Part 3, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.